Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to everybody on this lovely morning. Last weekend at about this time, I was sitting on the front porch of my shack in Pine County on the upper Tamarack River. And the week before, it had been quite rainy. Yeah, it's a little river. Actually, it tries to be a river. It's really not a river. But there had been a lot of rain, and it was looking pretty much like a river. Probably one of the 4 or 5 days out of the year that it looks like a river. And the water was very high. The day before, the water was very high. But the way little watersheds work, the water goes up and down pretty quickly. And so Saturday, we have this rock that's out. Actually, we don't have it. There's this rock that sits out in the river. And we use it as a water gauge to see. So we take notes whenever we're there, and kind of like what the temperature is and the wind and the cloud cover and the level of the water. And so on Saturday, the water was very high, which means we couldn't see the rock at all. That's very high. We have a little diagram in our notebook that tells us the little markings on the rock. So that we're always using the same terminology. It's very important to use the same terminology. But on Sunday, the water had come down, and there was a little peak of the rock showing on the river, in the river, above the surface of the river. The river was still moving pretty swiftly. A family of four common mergansers kind of flew in, and all somehow, one by one, landed on this little peak of the rock. So it was one adult female and three juvenile red-breasted mergansers. And they were all kind of standing there in this little peak, just pruning themselves, just doing that. And I was sitting, having my coffee, and watching them, and doing a little reading. And then the topic of this talk came into my mind. Because it dawned on me that these birds were heading south in just a couple months. And red-breasted mergansers spend the winter on the Gulf Coast, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Mexico. And so it just dawned on me. So these birds are headed to some probably some difficult months ahead, if not death. And then the topic of the talk came into my mind. So we have this oil well that is just spewing out oil ceaselessly in the Gulf. It's been described as the worst environmental disaster in history. The greatest environmental disaster in history. In many ways, in my mind, it is a manifestation of worldwide suffering. It is our reliance on oil, on petroleum, is just a manifestation of greed, really, and our dissatisfaction with life as it is. But we need more. We need cars and buildings, and we're just dissatisfied, and so we go out and we dig up minerals and oil, and we find ourselves in this situation. So for me, it's a manifestation of worldwide dis-ease, unease, suffering, or what Buddhists call dukkha. So the question is, how do we respond? How do we respond as human beings, little individual human beings? How do we respond in a way that is helpful, that is healthy, that maybe even helps get us out of this mess? It's not easy. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. And hopefully it won't be a downer. The images are... I don't watch a lot of TV. I do read newspapers and I do listen to the radio, and occasionally I'll watch TV. But the images are just everywhere constantly coming at us, as is news of disaster every day. I mean, that's why I say it's a manifestation. This is one little piece of what bombards us day in and day out about wars, about genocide, about environmental destruction. We're just inundated with this kind of information. So how do we respond? I'm first going to lay on you a little model that I have always found, I haven't always found it because I only discovered it about 3 or 4 years ago, but I have found to be useful as a way of thinking about our place in all of this. And it's a model that was put forward by Joanna Macy, and she built off of a model of or an idea that was presented by Lester Brown. Joanna Macy is a matriarch of Buddhist activism. She's a systems theorist. She's a Buddhist. She's a co-founder with Robert Aitken and Gary Snyder of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. She's kind of a mystic scientist, just a wonderful woman. And Lester Brown used to head up the World Watch Institute, so he's a policy environmentalist kind of guy. And he started with an idea, and she took it. And the idea, she put a Buddhist spin on it. She talks about the three turnings. And I've talked about this before, so if any of you have heard this and don't want to hear it again, just zone out for a little bit. So the three turnings, and that's a reference to Buddhist turnings. In Buddhist history or thinking, there have been two or three, and Marty thinks maybe four or five, turnings of the Dharma wheel. Turnings of the Dharma wheel. The first turning of the Dharma wheel was when the Buddha spoke. It's the Buddha's words. It's the sutras. The second turning of the wheel, generally, and people do, folks have different takes on this, but generally the second turning of the wheel was the Mahayana Reformation or Revolution, or the emphasis of emptiness, and that's considered the second turning. So, and... sometimes it's referred to a third turning. I think the Tibetans think that when Tibetan Buddhism became existent, that was the third turning. So they've got, so we Zen folks, I won't go into it. Anyway, so the turning of the Dharma wheel is a Buddhist concept. And so Joanna talks about the three turnings of the wheel. The first turning for her is the agricultural revolution. So she's talking about turnings of consciousness, which is in some ways the turning of the Dharma wheel. And she describes the agricultural revolution, which took place probably 10,000 years ago. It took a couple thousand years to kind of make the arc. And all sorts of things change. We all have read about, all of a sudden we have people had surpluses, human beings had surpluses, so they didn't have to constantly work and starve and work and starve. Domesticated animals, domesticated plants, moved from being nomads to living in villages and eventually cities. Trade became possible because there were surplus. So all of that changed over a period of 2,000 years. And in that change, or through that change, she would say, human beings went in with one consciousness and came out with another. That they did not, human beings did not think the way they thought at the end of the agricultural revolution, the way they did prior to it. They didn't think of the world the same way. Their values were entirely different. There was this huge change in human consciousness that was the agricultural revolution. She would say the second turning of the wheel was the industrial revolution. It occurred, 250, 300 years ago. It took about 150 years. And she would say the same thing happened in terms of socio-economic relations and hierarchies and what we could do with machines that we couldn't do without machines. But she would say that human consciousness coming out of the Industrial Revolution was not human consciousness going in. That we can't even imagine what human consciousness was prior to the Industrial Revolution. And then there's the third turning in this little model. And it's just a model. Don't take it too seriously. The third turning is what she calls the Environmental Revolution. And we're in the middle of it. And we don't have millennia to do it. We don't have centuries to do it. We're lucky if we have decades to do it, a couple of decades, and we're probably halfway through. And consciousness of human beings coming out will not be the same as consciousness going. We have to change our consciousness. We have to change the way we perceive the world. We have to change what our values are at a global level, systemic global level. That coming out of the Environmental Revolution, human beings won't be able to even imagine what our consciousness was like going in. She's not sure we're going to make it. That's the thing. She's not sure we're going to make it. But it's a nice little model for me to think about and play with, and it actually does help me in my day-to-day responding to these kinds of things. Joanna was also, she talks about having been invited with a bunch of kind of thinkers to during the Clinton administration to talk about the environmental crisis that we were in 15, 20 years ago during the Clinton administration. And she said it was amazing. I mean, people really got it. I mean, I think it was just North American or United States folks, but these folks understood what was happening. She said the scary thing was, best brains in the country, no one knew what to do about it. They knew what was happening, they knew what was coming down the pipe, they could see it, but no one could figure out what to do about it. So, Joanne, does anybody have a watch? I can see I'm going to need to keep control. There we go, that's great. I kind of get a run with it. Gotta watch myself, and I want to make sure I stop someplace where it's a little upbeat. In this model that Joanna put forward, she also says that there are three spheres of work that human beings need to do in order to address the environmental crisis. She said each one of them is absolutely important, and people sometimes work in one, and sometimes they work in another, and sometimes they go back and forth, but again, it's just a model. But the first sphere of work is saying no, is stopping the destruction. Yesterday as I was preparing for this talk, I got an e-blast from the Sierra Club, and they're going to do some demonstration at the Washington Monument, and I mean, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it, but I wasn't planning on going to the Washington Monument next week and doing this, but you need the Sierra Clubs. You need the attorneys going to court and trying to stop the destruction. As some of you know, I've been in jail a couple times trying to stop the destruction. You got to do that. People have to do that. Somebody's got to be applying the brakes. Somebody's got to be speaking truth. It's very tiring work. It's very burnout work. It's not pleasant work. But she would say people got to be doing it, and they've got to have support in doing it. The second sphere of work would be creating the new. Creating the new within the old. And she would say it's going on everywhere. It's under the radar. We're talking about new economic relationships, new way of decision making, new way of creating communities. And particularly in the day of the Internet, that stuff is happening faster and faster. I mean, people are creative. People are seeing it. And people are maybe not figuring out how to change global policy, but figuring out at a grassroots level how do we arrange things? How do we kind of bring things back to a place that's whole and healthy? That's a second sphere. And she would say that's really, there's a lot more going on than people realize. And it's going on all over the world. The third area that she would say people need to be working in is spiritual transformation. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I'm getting to the point of the talk. That there has to be that change in consciousness. And people actually have to, if you will, work at it. That's, she would probably say, being successful in any one of these areas isn't sufficient, but we need to be successful in all of those areas. So let me talk a little bit about that third area. And let me start by reading a quote from the Buddha, also referred to as Tathagata. It also referred to as the World Honored One. One day the Tathagata picked up a piece of dirt, put it on his fingertip, showed it to the assembly and said, "Is there more soil in the 3,000,000-fold worlds or on my fingertip?" So 3,000, you could use anything. Today we might use the universe, the Milky Way, but he's talking like a big amount of dirt, right? At that time, Ananda, who was his attendant, straight man is in Laurel and Hardy, not as in me. But. At that time, Ananda replied to the Buddha, "There is more soil in the 3,000,000-fold worlds. It cannot be compared to the soil on your fingertip." Now, if you know anything about Buddhism, that could be right, that could be wrong. So you can't, you don't know what the Buddha's going to say here. The World Honored One said, "Those who receive human bodies in the southern continent are like the soil on my fingertip. Those who do not receive human bodies in the southern continent are like the soil in the 3,000,000-fold worlds. To be born and encounter the Buddha Dharma is even more rare than this." So what the World Honored One said, "Those who receive human bodies in the southern continent are like the soil on my fingertip." The southern continent is, in the cosmology of the day, where the continent on which human beings were born. So he's saying to be born, those who are born humans are like the soil, they are rare. To have human consciousness is very, very rare. Very rare indeed. And those who do not receive human bodies in the southern continent are like the vast universe. To be born, to be rare, a human being, and to encounter the Buddha Dharma is even more rare than this. So we have human consciousness, and it indeed is rare, and it indeed is a young phenomenon in the universe. It is not other than the universe. It is one manifestation of the universe. But it is rare indeed, and our work, I think we should hold that. That to have human consciousness is rare, and we should hold that. And we should hold that. I don't often talk about things being sacred, but we should hold that in a sacred manner. So here we have this environmental crisis, and we're human beings on the planet. How do we respond? And I'd like to talk about three different ways that we can respond as human beings facing the world we face. And the first one is meditation, personal awareness. awareness of what is arising in the present moment without the concepts, without our stories about what's arising. To simply, because this is what human consciousness, we have the ability to be aware of the moment. That's what human consciousness is. That's what our practice is. And I think it's a practice that we do on the cushion, but we need to do throughout the day. Because as we practice, we realize that there's nothing different between what we call nature and ourselves. We recognize that there are no lines whatsoever. So the practice brings that into our attention. It brings into our attention that the world is not how we conceive it. The world is not how we conceive it. Our consciousness, our collective consciousness, our individual consciousness and our collective consciousness has a conception of what the world is, but it isn't what the world is. And when Joanna Macy talks about coming out one end of the environmental revolution with a different consciousness, it's a different perception, a different conception of what the world is and how the world hangs together and what our place is in it. Now, it's probably no more legitimate than going in, but hopefully it'll be more helpful. I put on the program a quote from Albert Einstein. Somebody want to read it?
The problems that exist in the world today cannot be solved by the level of thinking that created them. Albert Einstein.
So he's talking about a change in consciousness too, I think. Another quote from him around this idea of seeing the world as it is, or seeing the world, being aware of it without our conceptions. He once said, "Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a persistent one." Reality is merely illusion, albeit a persistent one. We aren't going to get out of this mess with the policy thinking that Joanna Macy ran. Great people, great minds. That's not what's going to get us out of this. There has to be some shift that is deeper, if you will, than thinking our way out of it with the same thought patterns, same thinking that got us into it. So I think our practice, our meditation practice, is incredibly important to the resolution in the public sphere. Second element, I think, that will be helpful is to think like a mountain. Tim, a couple weeks ago, did a guided meditation that was thinking like a mountain, getting into the space of being just there through the seasons, through the rainstorms, through the hot days, through the cycles of birth and death, but just being there. Just being there. And I think what's going to help get us out of this mess is thinking like a mountain. John Kabat-Zinn, in this regard, has a great take. He says, anger and self-righteousness are not going to be helpful. They are not going to be helpful. Mountains don't exhibit anger or self-righteousness. And he gave the example. He said, I can get, this is John Kabat-Zinn, he said, I can get angry and self-righteous when something happens, like the deep water horizon explosion. When I think there's a human agent that can be blamed for greed, that can be blamed for making bad decisions, that can be blamed for something. He said, I can get very self-righteous and angry in those situations, but I can't get self-righteous and angry if there's a monsoon that kills people. Self-righteousness and anger doesn't rise. Now. They only arise when we posit an agent, a human. Now, Katrina is an interesting case because that was a natural disaster, but by God, there was the Army Corps of Engineers. They were making bad decisions. There was the administration. They weren't. So we could get angry and self-righteous. Some of us could get angry and self-righteous. But it wasn't about the storm. It was about the human agency and ineptitude and greed and disregard for safety or human life. But we can only get angry and self-righteous when we posit an agent, a human agent, which is really a simplification, an oversimplification, that assumes things should be happening differently or should have happened differently. But this is it. We got the deep water horizon spewing oil out into the Gulf of Mexico. Should and shouldn't is quite irrelevant. We can look at BP, we can look at the people at BP, we can look at the president or people in his administration and say, oh, we can get angry and they caused it. Folks, it's part and parcel of what's unfolding in this moment now. And sure there's greed, and sure there's... self-righteousness and anger are not going to be helpful. And they are really only our response to what we create. We create this oversimplified system that somehow two or three people, or four or five people, or a corporation was responsible for that. That oil well is part and parcel of, what, 250 years of us sucking oil? Us sucking oil out of the earth. And we can kind of blame something, we can kind of pinpoint something and say, oh, yeah, it's as it is. There's should and shouldn't are irrelevant. Doesn't mean you don't want to create rules and regulations and laws. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying, what's our response? How do we get out of the mess? More rules and regulations are helpful if you're working in the second sphere or the first sphere. They're not helpful in the third sphere. And the other thing about things like deep water horizon is we have this idea of an ideal world where disasters don't happen. I mean, it's not the history of the world. I'm teaching a course on one of the a 9th century poem, Chinese poem, and it was at a time in the 8th century, 754, I think. There was the Anshan Revolution in China, and the area that was controlled by Chang'an. In 8 years, the population went from 60 million to 16 million due to a rebellion. It was a rebellion. So we think disasters are not, catastrophes are new, but they are with us and they will be with us. What do we do with them? So the third way of kind of a response that I think can be helpful, besides our personal practice of meditation and awareness of the moment without our stories and concepts, and thinking long term when we respond to a crisis or catastrophe, is to simply bear witness. To simply bear witness as human consciousness. The power of that has been proven by, in social movements by people like Gandhi and Joan of Arc and Martin Luther King. But imagine simply bearing witness, not just one human consciousness bearing witness, but thousands and millions of human consciousness just bearing witness to the destruction in a open-hearted and deep way, in a very grounded way. Joanna Macy talks about nuclear power. And I've said this before, if we think Deepwater Horizon is bad, wait till, as we're storing nuclear wastes, and lots of them, and they're growing, these nuclear waste piles are growing and growing and growing. Wait till the first accident happens with that. It'll make Deepwater Horizon pale, I think, in comparison. But Joanna, and this is where thinking, this is there has to be this shift, and I'm kind of laying the groundwork for what, I have no idea what the shift will be. I don't have any idea whether the shift will take place in consciousness. But she talks about creating, in essence, stewardship councils with to basically keep watch over nuclear wastes. Civilian stewardship councils that would have to last for thousands, tens of thousands of years. But people committed to protecting the rest of us from this, from the poison that is nuclear waste. Taking your meditation into the world, taking your awareness into the world, thinking long term, and bearing witness. And again, I'm talking about work in the spiritual area. That's if you want to give money to Sierra Club, or you want to, there are these other spheres to work in. But this, the third sphere, I'm not calling for action. And I think where we are as people, with as we look at this kind of disaster and other disasters around the globe, what can we do in this complex world with all of this stuff going down? Is really our koan. It's the koan of our age. What can we do? What do we do? So many of us see it coming. I mean, we see it coming. What can we do that is helpful? And I maintain that sitting on the cushion is important, but I also maintain that we have a responsibility to get off the cushion and bring what Buddhist meditation has to offer in the world to the world. And we have to stay with that uncertainty and that question and that koan. We have to stick with it. We have to hold it. We can't turn away from it and ignore it. That's not going to be helpful. That's not going to be helpful. We have to kind of embrace the situation we find ourselves in as human, as consciousness, individually and collectively. And some of you know, I've been involved in the Buddhist Peace Fellowship over the years. And I have this firm belief that what the Buddha taught was quite incredible. Quite incredible. On the level of what Einstein learned and taught. And is valuable to us. And those of us who are in the rare situation of being human beings and having been exposed to the Buddha Dharma, in my mind, in this time, in this age, we have an obligation not to evangelize, but to offer up. And not that it's going to solve the issues, because we need human smarts, we need all sorts of other things, we need people in all the spheres. But I think we have something of an obligation to offer up the teachings of the Buddha and the practices of the Buddha to the world, because I think it's going to be important, very important. So as we have sometimes discover in our meditation, when we drop away the preconceived notions, we drop away our storylines, we drop away our conditioning, all of a sudden new things open up that were never on the radar screen, never within our vision because we were so constricted. So as this is the hopeful piece, as that happens, and some of us have experienced in our meditation practice, that can happen at a larger level when we begin to drop away the stories of bad guys and good guys, the way things have to be, the way we get our energy, the way our governments interact. When we drop away all those stories, and they are just stories, new things, hopefully, will be possible. The problems that exist in the world today cannot be solved by the level of thinking that created them. And my talk is not to call you or spur you to action. My talk is simply to hold your human consciousness very lovingly and open-heartedly in your hand and practice practice the Buddha way. Okay, I'm done. Any comments or questions?
Lee, this is an interesting topic because I just finished this book called The World Without Us, and it's written by a guy whose premise is, what would the world do if we just totally disappeared, not war, not pestilence, but we just disappeared? And I just finished it last night, and he basically, in the end, says that the world would just, for most of the world's history, the dominant species was like a small rodents, or small beings. The larger beings weren't only dominated the world for such a short fraction of time.
Yeah.
And the thing is, in my mind, is I was involved professionally with the environmental movement 27 years ago, and I've kept my eye on it ever since then. And I remember when I was a kid. In the 60s, the environmental movement was there, and I mentioned that to a friend yesterday who was much younger than me and wasn't aware, like that song, "If you live in American cities, you will find it very pretty. Just one thing you must be aware, don't touch the water, don't breathe the air." That's 68, and that's when I remember the movement starting. But the question in my mind is, we've used our rational thought that has been facilitated by self to do all these things in the world that create more for humankind. Was it ever, was rational thought ever meant to save the world? Because the world clearly is going to be okay without us. The only thing really won't be okay without us is maybe our dogs and our hair and the lice that live on our body. But the rest of the world is going to take care of it. Was rational thought, is it the be-all and end-all? Are we being selfish when we think that rational thought is going to get us out of this mess when it never was meant to function that way? And or maybe, that's a premise. It was ever meant to function to get us out of the mess. What it has done is created our population and generated, facilitated to exist beyond its means. Do you think that we can actually, that there is a higher level of consciousness that will get us the hell out of this mess?
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah. I think another great mind was Darwin's, and I think it. I view it as evolution. I don't think there's any reason. Again, thinking like a mountain, thinking long term. There's no reason to assume that human species, a very short time on this earth, and we've done a lot to it in that time. And again, you can get into this dichotomy about human beings and the earth and human beings and other species. That's a dichotomy. It's an unreal dichotomy. It's an unreal separation of what's going on. I mean, everything co-evolves. Everything's co-evolving. We've co-evolved with everything, and everything's co-evolving with us. We aren't really separate. We couldn't have evolved had it not been for everything else that was evolving. But species come and species go, and we have human consciousness is fascinating. I mean, isn't it fascinating? I mean, the fact that we can be sitting here talking about this, I mean, other species don't do it, right? I mean, that's the Buddha's point. And to think that we have control is really hubris of the puts all of the ancients to shame in terms of amount of hubris. I think human consciousness is more than rational thought, number one. I think rational thought is going to be part of what maybe helps get us out of this. But as Joanna Macy said, or as she said, she's just not sure that we're going to make it through. And it reminds me of the Dalai Lama. He spent so many years trying to reestablish Tibetan culture, or get back to Tibet and allow the culture to thrive there. But he's also very willing to let it go if that's not the way it unfolds. And I think. I think I've forgotten what your question was.
That was kind of like a point. We kind of put ourselves on a pedestal by considering, by thinking that rational thought is the be all and end all. In that the world has intelligence, its own intelligence, yes, beyond our ability to rationalize it, and can we use this little tool that helped us get to where we're at now and in this mess, can we use that same tool, which obviously isn't the be-all and end-all, to get us, not the world, but us out of this mess? Because the world, at least the premise is, the world's going to be fine without us. In fact, it might be better off.
This dichotomy of us and the world somehow being different. It's not, and that our species might not be here and the world be continue going on without us is, I think, perfectly legitimate to think about. But I think it's our rational mind that creates that separation between us and the rest of the world.
My intuition is it has a lot to do with experiment, and it's humility disappears, the consciousness that arises in another being or in another place. But as we bear witness, then maybe the fact that we're like the somatic system of the organism, and when we when we stop reading the organism as a whole, and stop doing that duty of the somatic system, and we start reacting just to ourselves and our human concerns, and that's where it becomes troublesome to us. So we're just constantly in a cycle of reaction that gets further and further away from the whole being. So say it's in our own experience of our individual organism, if we feel burning, then we react to the benefit of the organism to remove ourselves from the situation. But if we feel burning, and then that sensation system continues to be like, it's burning, what will we do, and it goes on and on, away from the source of the initial sensation, then it's not beneficial to go on.
The thing is, in my mind, is that in the time sequence of the world, someone suggested that humankind has been around. If the whole the existence of the world is a year, humankind has been around the last second of the year, basically December 31st, 11:59 and 59 seconds. Why would we be the stewards of the world in such a small timeline? Do we really? Is that hubris to consider us to be part of the witness of the world when we've been around for such a small period of its existence?
Well, if we don't, we will.
Well, maybe something else is looking.
I think it's really not helpful, although we have to do it, is to make the distinction that differentiates us between. We have to do it. And we have to act now as human beings. I mean, that's the koan. And yeah, I think it is. I agree. We have a tendency towards hubris, but that does not, in my mind, that does not remove responsibility to act given who we are and where we are. And then this idea about witness, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, maybe that's what meditation is simply being witness to the unfolding in the moment in a way that is helpful, as opposed to being witness with our intellectual mind.
I think this whole conversation is evidence of the transformation of consciousness that you were discussing. The fact that we're trying to figure out where our brains are going to be in 10 years, where they are now.
Well, it's late. There are some teachers who do not like to bring this stuff up for good reason. Well, maybe not good reason. We can get off on this kind of big picture kind of attempt to understand and resolve. And what I want to do is encourage you to go deeper in your practice, your meditation. Think like a mountain and bear witness. And out of that, who knows what will come? But that seems to be the way something will come that will not be the thinking that got us into this. And I'm not saying don't go out and protest. I'm not saying don't create new ways. I'm not saying don't work in those other fields. But I am saying that there's important work to be done on the spiritual level. And that's what this center is here to help support.